Hello. It's episode 461 of Radio Free Nintendo, and I'm your host, James Jones. Returning this week, after a long absence, it's Mr. John Lindemann.
It's great to be back, James.
It's good to have you back, John. Did you enjoy your time away from the show?
Yeah, you know, it was gave me some time to sit back and reflect on everything that RFN means to me.
I don't know if I want to hear this reflection, so let's move on. Mr. Greg Leahy, hello.
Hello, everyone.
How are you doing today, Greg?
Much the same as any other day, except this is a time when I don't have to worry about the Patriots winning the Super Bowl in a few days' time, so I guess it could be worse.
Excellent. And lastly, Guillaume, let's have some idle chatter.
Yeah, well, I don't really give a shit about sports, but apparently the Habs aren't really doing well. That I know, so.
Yeah, they've shit the bed, FYI. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Just great.
And that will conclude RFN this week. If you want to hear more sports talk, you can email us at rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. I guess we also have to do new business. Guillaume.
Yes?
So, what have you been playing?
Sure. So last week on the Virtual Console, Zack and Wiki came out. Zack and Wiki, one of the earliest Wii games that I remember IGN evangelizing. Because back then, I posted on IGN message boards, and I listened to the word of Casamassina. Right. Yep. Anyway, so I listened to his word, if not his name, and so I bought it thinking, well, you know, I like old school LucasArts adventure games from back in the day, and I like the Wii so far, and I'll probably like this. And so I checked. I still have my old save file. I didn't buy the game for $25 Canadian on the Wii U. I still had my copy, so I popped it in, and I checked my old file, and I haven't played this game since November 2007. And nice. So it's been nearly 10 years of thinking that maybe I'll get back to this game. And it took a re-release to shame me into actually doing that. Turns out that I had only completed the first world and I had stopped there. And earlier this week, I finished the first world again. I started over and I probably intend to stop there as well.
So Kiel, this game is over 8 years old. So could you kind of give a quick explanation for what it is?
Can someone truly explain? You've got Zack and Wiki.
Zack is this fatalistic nonsense.
Well, it doesn't really. I don't know. Zack and Wiki. Zack is this aspiring pirate. He's very, very cartoony, and his companion is this golden monkey flying thing / Belle, and together, they get treasure, I guess. And you crash land on this treasure island, luckily enough for them. And you've got Barbarus, this fabled pirate who has been transformed into various golden shiny objects that have been scattered into these chests. And so he's like, well, you're looking for treasure. I'm stuck in these chests. Why don't you complete my body for me? And that's about as far as I've ever gotten into the story, because Barbarus is probably never going to get rescued by me. It's just a point-and-click adventure game. Closer than... It's not really a LucasArts-style game. If anyone has ever played the Goblins games from Sierra Online, that's what I would compare it to, because this game has, unlike LucasArts games, has death. So there are times when if you click on the wrong thing at the wrong time, Zack is going to get squished by a boulder or something similar, and it's game over. And if you want to continue, you have to use up a life, and then you're going to start from the last checkpoint. Otherwise, you start the level over, which is pretty annoying. So you click on different items, and you interact with them, and you know, you try to solve logic puzzles, and for the most part, the logic is sound. I mean, like, you're going to have this giant gorilla-like creature, and Wiki is going to warn you that, well, you know, he's afraid of fire. That's probably how you can control him. And yes, sure, there's a campfire near you, and you just have to go find some sticks to light them on fire and drive him away. The thing is, this is an early Wii game, as I said, so it's going to be accompanied by motion controls. You gotta find a saw somewhere, and then you get the saw, you use it on the sticks, and then you're gonna be wiggling the Wii Remote back and forth as if you were actually sawing off the sticks. So that comes a lot in the game. The motion controls in those sequences work well enough, but it's just like, it really makes you feel like you're playing something from 2007.
What? Why? Because that was the time when every single thing had to have, you know, waggle?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. The game is well made enough. Like, it looks good. The characters are surprisingly well done. Like, most of them are pretty funny. Like, Zack has actually, you know, he's pretty cute. He's always munching on the candy bars when you leave him idle. And I don't know. Like, I'm surprised how much of the game holds up. I'm not too surprised by how much I still hate Wiki, who has this kind of this whiny baby voice.
I remember Johnny saying that Wiki was like the cutest character going at the time.
Really? Huh.
Yeah. There's audio evidence.
This is the guy who freaked out about an airplane in a Chibi Robo spinoff.
It's true, but Toby is pretty cute. I don't know. Wiki has nothing on Toby, but yeah, like it's all the game is decent enough. But yeah, after finishing one world, I'm like, okay, I think I've had enough of this. There's nothing really to drive me forward. I'm like, I'm playing and I'm not too engaged, and it's. I think that the main thing that gets in the way is the live system. Remember how much importance I gave, like, both when I talked about it as new business and when I talked about it in my top five, Boxboy. You could always kind of turn back to the latest checkpoint, which was always after the last action you did, after the last puzzle you solved, and that was so liberating to be able to make a mistake and, whoop, I can try again immediately from where I died. And Zack and Wiki is very much not like that. You've got three tries, so you've got some stuff that can insta-kill you. I mean, like, sometimes you're just not going to be able to avoid dying. Like, there might be a bunch of cannibals at the bottom of a cliff, and there's a vine that you can climb down, and you've got this mushroom that would make them sleepy, and they're stirring this giant bowl of soup, just like, you know, in so many cartoons, and you're like, well, maybe I can go down there and they won't see me, or maybe they'll see me, and it's just, there's no way to know unless you try, so you try it, and then you're dead, and you have to use up one of your lives.
Yeah, I never liked that part of it. I think it just discourages experimentation, which is part of the fun of this kind of game. It's different items. Let's try combining them and all that. And yeah, I mean, it didn't deter me from playing through the whole game back in 2008, and I enjoyed it. And to some extent, I enjoyed it more as it went on because the puzzles became more sophisticated. And then there were other aspects of the game that were less enjoyable as it went on because the live stuff became like more of an issue, or, you know, the gotcha stuff kind of was more irritating. But
because I
cannot really think of a good reason why it was the way it was.
Sometimes we're going to be, well, okay, I don't want to waste my life here because I almost just started. So you're going to start over the whole level just because, for no good reason.
Right.
The only way, as far as I've seen, to get lives back is to buy them. And so that means kind of scouring the levels to find hidden coins. And when you buy lives, this is a Capcom game. If anyone has started playing Beautiful Joe, this will be familiar to you. But when you buy lives, the price goes up every time.
No, I mean, I think any disincentive or sort of discouragement of experimentation, I just don't think is a good idea in this game. I don't.
Right.
I tended to avoid buying lives as much as I could, so I probably ended up doing more repetition than I should. But, you know, however you choose to handle it, you know, whether it may be, you know, there was a way that you could end up like cheesing it somehow to buy more lives. I don't know. I never pushed the boundaries of that. But even that being taken as given, I didn't agree with it then. Right. And I'm not surprised. It probably, you know, even seems more out of place now, to be honest.
Yeah, well, back then it wasn't great either. I thought that's the reason why I stopped playing, right? So this is the kind of game that I think is worth checking out. So get it from your library or get it used somewhere. But $20 on the eShop, I think, is a little bit steep. Yeah, so that's not the only thing that I've been playing, though. I have received Final Fantasy Explorers, It's a strange game because, yes, as every review has said, and as is very clear when you just look at it, it's very much Monster Hunter inspired. But it really doesn't go for the same kind of depth or the same kind of learning the enemy behavior, learning your how your moves work, you know, like the timing of your attacks and how to dodge and everything like that. It's a little bit more RPG-ish than that. Like it's very Monster Hunter-esque in that you do collect different things to craft new items. And there's not really a leveling up element, but there's one town. You start out in one town, you go to the quest giver, you take a series of quests that you finish, and then you collect these materials as you go, and you craft more gear for your character, and then you go do some bigger, more tough quests. So very Monster Hunter-esque, but kind of maybe like my first Monster Hunter. You know, like it's very much simpler. The first few missions that I did just had me going through the field and killing these minor enemies, and literally like I would one-shot them right away. Like there was absolutely no challenge at all. And I still haven't gotten to the point where I've dealt with some of the bigger monsters that would actually be a threat. I did deal with some like bigger monsters that, yeah, sure, like didn't get killed in one shot, but I know that the eventually the game has you go against Eidolons, which is Final Fantasy speak for a big bad monster.
How do they Final Fantasy-ize this game?
Well, it's very much Final Fantasy in that you've got the class system, the job system. You can change into a monk, or a white mage, or a black mage, or a knight. And so from there, you get different abilities. The enemies are from Final Fantasy. You're going to see Ifrit and, you know, all the classic summons. So there's that cosmetic aspect to it, but there's also, like the different classes and the way that you combat. The combat is very simplistic. You've got this, you mash the Y button to do this basic attack, but you can also have, your various skills set to, you hold down the L or R triggers and press, one of the four face buttons, and you've assigned abilities to all of them. So, you know, as a monk, I've got a various abilities to you know, bash enemies' faces in. So some of the more involved abilities that I have are going to be counter, where, you know, like if I do it just before a physical attack, then I'm going to, you know, not take damage and do a counter attack, and then I'm going to have basically my next attack after that is going to be a critical. Of course, if the enemy is a dragon and spits fire in my face, my counter is useless. So there's, you know, there's strategy to be had here, but it's so far, the game hasn't thrown any challenge at me. I'm going to be talking about this game more in the future because, you know, the meat of the game, really, just like in Monster Hunter, is the online play or playing with other people. So yeah, I'll be able to talk about it more deeply next week.
Cool. I'll look forward to it. I mean, the fact that there even are summons sort of gives you an idea of this being more Final Fantasy-y than a Monster Hunter game.
Right. Well, when I say summon, I mean the summons from other games are in this game, but they're actually the monsters that you hunt.
Oh!
I don't know if you actually have this summoning class. I guess I'll see later, but I haven't.
So you hunt like Ifrit and all of those,
right?
Dudes.
So I think those are the Eidolons that I mentioned earlier.
Gotcha.
And yeah,
I do recall seeing during like a Japanese stream of this game that you could turn into like heroes of Final Fantasy or some weird thing like that.
Yeah, that still hasn't happened. There's a lot going on.
Yeah, it sounds pretty late game, I guess. But definitely, Guillaume, I guess you're going to be looking for people to play online at some point.
Yeah. I mean, if anyone is playing right now, I'll probably...
We're recording a podcast right now, so...
That's true. Yeah, I can't play. I'm sorry. please contact me on Twitter or whatever.
All right, well, I don't have anything new to talk about this week, because in preparation for my transformation to become the Ice Wolf, as a blizzard came down on us. I procured a horrifying number of PlayStation era RPGs. And I talked about on the show last week that I just bought up a tremendous number of them. And I decided that I was going to go after the one that I thought I could conceivably beat if I ended up being stuck in the house for 3 or 4 days. I didn't, but Suikoden, the original Suikoden for the PlayStation, is the one that I ended up starting because it was the shortest one on the list.
Yeah, it's a lean, mean RPG, just about like 20, 25 hours long if you...
If you critical path it, basically.
Yeah.
I'm at about 15, so I'm pretty deep in at this point. So... First off, what is Suikoden? It is an SNES looking RPG with load times. Like, you could tell this is a very early PlayStation game because it looks very 16-bit with some higher res textures and CD audio. Like, that's what this game is. It's basically, as it starts out, it's not really particularly special of a JRPG. It doesn't do anything that different from what its predecessors were doing, except there is a tremendously huge number of party members. 103, specifically.
Really? 107?
107, maybe. Yeah, something like that. It's 100 and then between 1 and 9. So, but there are a lot of them, and you have to do... So most of them, you just walk up to them and they tell you their life story as can be delivered in two blocks of text in English, which is probably much more profound in Japanese where stuff is more condensed. And then you have the choice to recruit them or not. And then most of them just go, yeah, I'll join this rebellion you're leading against the kingdom. Sure, why not?
Mm-hmm.
Some of them will give you something weird like, yeah, I'll join you if you find soap. And you're like, oh, I have to find soap.
And there was one guy who will... join you if you beat him at gambling.
Yes, there's three.
Save often.
There's three of them, actually.
Ugh.
One of them is playing dice.
Yeah.
He's story critical. You have to do him. One of them's doing a memory card game. He's not story critical. And then one of them is doing... I can't remember what it's called, but it's basically follow the ball under the cups.
Right.
And it's not random. It's like random seeded by like your name or something. Which I figured out pretty quickly is I didn't realize like the first five were always the same, no matter how fast and how much I bet. So I just mapped out his first 30 and then maxed out my money. So at the very, very, very beginning of the game, I had max money in this game. once I realized it wasn't random, I'm like, oh, well, let's get rich.
Mm-hmm.
So basically you go from place to place, you collect party members as you go, and you complete these little... self-contained storylets that are sort of drawing together the narrative of you becoming disenfranchised with the kingdom you live in and ultimately trying to overthrow its government. You know, it's kind of not particularly, you know, fertile or new ground here, but it does some things with how the characters are represented, some of the characters that you meet and their relationship with who they were before all this started and who they've become as the game goes on. All that's fine. And of course, there's 100 plus characters, so it makes games like, Chrono Cross seem conservative by comparison.
Sure, but they're not all going to be in your party.
No,
like some
God,
of them
no.
are going to be like you've at some point you find this abandoned castle and you decide, well, it's going to be my castle, damn it. And one of your party members might be like the cook.
Yeah.
And he's not going to follow you in battle. He's just gonna...
I mean, you could put him in your party. You shouldn't, but you can. You can put every person in your party.
Really?
Yeah. So But to Guillaume's point, there's a little bit of Skies of Arcadia here, which of course is kind of backwards because Skies of Arcadia came out way later. But as you recruit these characters, they move into your base and they build your base. So I recruited an innkeeper. So previously, I couldn't do anything in the castle. Like I had some people just basically hanging out on like the second floor of the castle, being like, "Man, we got a cool castle," but they weren't really doing anything. So I recruited her, and now there was an inn in the castle. And inns are incredibly vital in this game because you heal in them and you save in them. So you couldn't actually save in the castle before, so you had to leave the castle and come back if you wanted to save, which is a real pain in the butt. You can get like a shop owner, so you can get an armor owner. You can get the you don't buy weapons in this game; you improve them at forges. So you can, as you bring on more of these blacksmiths, and they start staffing your forge, you can go better and better on your weapon.
Right, like
upgrades.
You get like basically the apprentice, and then you find the normal one, and then his master. Eventually, you find him.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. So they're standing around in like color coded clothing in there. As the game goes, the castle just becomes a more and more lively place. And at some point, people start, you know, occupying the basement. They start moving up to the top of the very top of the castle. They go out on the grounds and start setting up, or some of them set up in like a boathouse. And sometimes people get shuffled as new people come in. So you're constantly having to kind of move around to learn where everything is. One guy runs a bathhouse in your castle that he continually makes nicer as you go. My favorite find was I found this woman who gives you a mirror that lets you warp back to the castle, right to the basement of the castle where she's set up. And then I found another mage who hangs out with her and has amnesia, because of course she does.
Somebody has to. It's a JRPG.
Who gives you the ability to teleport to any city you've been to. Which basically means you now have the ability, if you carry that mirror around with you, to just go anywhere in the game, from anywhere else in the game, in fairly rapid succession, which was a nice get. So it's worth stepping out of the critical path to go try to track down people. Where the game does differently than just standard JRPG, I bring my party into battle, we fight enemies, random enemies, we get to a boss, we fight the boss, story sequence. What it does differently is occasionally you get these battles. And I don't mean battles like, you know, normal JRPG battles, but like actual battles, like between armies. And there's nothing really strategic about them. It's really kind of a rock, paper, scissors thing where you have a certain number of forces and your enemy has a certain number of forces. And you're essentially trying to inflict damage to drive them down to zero before they do the same to you. So you'll have access to the skill set of each of your stars of destiny. So the more of them you have, the more options you have available to you. And a lot of them get grouped together, so they're stronger that way. So right now I've got two sets of three mages. And so they just wreck house. So as long as they don't pick something that rock, paper, scissors beats magic, I get to knock out half their army at the very beginning. So there's a lot of these kinds of like, all right, I'm gonna use these skills and I'm gonna knock out their enemy and they're gonna do that to me. And eventually you try to drive them down to zero. It's pretty easy except for the times where the game wants you to lose, but you don't know that. So you fret it for a while, then realize that you were just set up anyway. So it doesn't matter. I'm not super in love with this game. It is exceedingly primitive.
Yeah.
In some really kind of jarring ways when you realize it's not. I mean, it's about 20 years old, but you think about some of the Super Nintendo RPGs that were coming out before this, and you think, wow, this game could have really used some help. So I just got the map maker 15 hours into the game, and none of the cities are labeled on the map anyways. It doesn't matter. But frequently the game would just tell you, go to this city. Well, the game world's gigantic. The game world is huge. And you're like, where? Where do I go? And that is really frustrating when the random battles seem to be like every five steps. You're like, Now the game does let you just, if you're really strong over them, you can just basically hit run away with 100% success. They actually call it let go versus run when you're kind of more at their level. And it is very easy to level up characters very quickly because the experience scales.
Hmm.
So I took a level 12 and got them to level 35 in about 4 minutes.
Yeah, that's one of the things I remember liking about the game. The battles, even despite the load times, the battles were zippy. Like, they take no time at all. Like, usually your party members will attack at the same time instead of waiting for their turns. And yeah, like, the leveling up takes no time at all. So I don't remember grinding.
Well, it takes no time at all if you're under the level of the enemies, because it's a very aggressive experience scaling where once you're kind of at level with them, it really slows down. And once you go over, I mean, you can't grind. You may get 5 experience for a battle.
Right.
The grinding is a functional impossibility at this point. So there are some things about it that are convenient. It's just sometimes having to figure out where the game wants you to go or what it wants you to do at a given moment. I did finally recruit somebody who gives you a kind of a rundown of where you are in the story. So if you step away for a little while, you really need her because you're like, where was I supposed to go? And she actually has been better about telling you where these cities are. So that's been helpful. But you know, there's just some stuff where you're like, maybe this was a conceit of them not having much text space to work with the whole Japanese to English text boxes thing. But sometimes the game just seems like it withholds info in a way that is not, like, it couldn't have been intentional. Like, if you're taking somebody to a new part of the world and you're telling them to go somewhere, you're not going to neglect to tell them where that place is. So why would you do that unless you just did it because you had to? So there's some stuff in there that's kind of like, eh, all right, I guess. But, you know, I am pushing through it. I do kind of like where the story's going. And to Guillaume's point, most of the actual story missions are quite short. So, you know, you may be sent to go retrieve this weapon that the Resistance has been working on, the Liberation Army, as it were. And basically you walk to this town, you go back, you walk through the town, then you go out the back to another place, you get it, you fight some random battles, but you're probably back at your castle 7 or 8 minutes after you left. Even the ones that have bosses, the dungeons are very, very short by and large. So you're just sort of going to the dungeon, kill the boss, it's over, story sequence, and then the game sort of drops you back in the, well, do what you want to do and explore for a while mindset. So it pays off to go back and look for the other recruitable members, and the game gives you plenty of time to do it. So on that front, it works pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Now, isn't Suikoden 2 the one that's considered the real classic?
It's definitely considered the better game of the two.
Right, and it was super rare because Konami released it like a 2D sprites-based game against, what, Final Fantasy VIII or something?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, no one bought it. No one bought it. So, yeah. But it was very highly respected, and physical version went for like $200, you know, if you wanted to try it to get it. And recently it got released on PSN, so yep. for $10, that's a steal, right?
Yeah.
I still haven't played it, but I know that there are some elements, like you transfer, your save transfers.
Yep. And there's a
that's pretty
so,
cool.
So that game takes place fairly quickly after this one. So a lot of the characters that you met in this game, a lot of the people in the party wind up in the party of that game too.
Right.
Which is the effect of the save transfer.
Hmm. But apparently there's some bugs with the transfer. So apparently you're the first, whatever name you gave to your character, the first letter is going to bleed into the second game. And by default, he's supposed to be called Megdahl. And if you called your guy, you know, William, then you're going to get Wekdahl.
Wait, really? Because the last name's not, you can't pick the last name. You pick the first name.
Yeah, I know, but the first letter of the first name
is going to
bleed into... Yeah, like it's apparently it's pretty weird. And the way to get around that is to have a name that's more than seven letters long, but that only works if they're all uppercase. So, I bet you wish you had known that before you started playing, James.
What the F? What the F? That's bizarre.
Well, the second game apparently is full of bugs like that and localization problems because there's a whole town apparently where they just did not have time to localize the game, so it's just a bunch of random letters.
That's amazing. Like there's definitely some spots in this game where I'm like, oh, the localizers went to sleep. Like there's just sentences that seem apropos of nothing that a character says to you, and you're like, what? What the fuck? Konami gonna Konami.
Yeah, Konami cares. I think this is one of their slogans.
I mean, we make fun of what Konami has become, but they were always kind of slack ass about stuff.
slack ass? I've never heard that before.
But to John, to your point, to two, as Guillaume pointed out, two seemed, one seemed very primitive when it came out, but there were other, and I talked about Wild Arms not that long ago. I mean, the JRPGs in the early PlayStation era that looked like 16-bit games with higher resolution or better textures wasn't that uncommon.
Yep.
Like it happened. But you have that, once that sorts of falls away and you start to see the pivot towards the more showy stuff, games like Wild Arms 2 seem very anachronistic almost.
Mm-hmm.
It's really until that series moved to the PS2 where they went, okay, we actually have to try to make this series look... Because 2 looks a lot better than 1, but it's still... pales in comparison to like the pre-rendered backgrounds that Square Enix was pumping out in games and stuff like that.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But today, I mean, it's probable that
we
would probably be more okay with the 2D sprites of Suikoden than we would be with the big polygons of Final Fantasy VII.
The sprites don't look so good when they're up-resed HD, but that's not super surprising.
You can turn that off though.
Well, yeah, but it's still going to stretch across my TV. Like I can't unless I want to make it super small on my TV.
There's options.
Yeah, I could turn on the blur, which is a PS3 feature where it'll just blur, which it just makes everything look really muddy. But yeah, so it's really when they moved to PS2 that they started trying to get showy with this franchise. And then I think after 3, there's sort of a kind of a known drop-off. And if Konami...
Well, I think even already at 3, they had lost the original creator, like the...
They did, yes. Yeah,
the guy whose vision this was.
Yeah, I think 3's regard is still being a good game, and then 4, it's like, okay, where are you guys going now? And 4 also never made it to PSN, and if Konami weren't dead, I don't think it would anyway. So, it is what it is. You know, I'm gonna grind through it and get it done, and probably not pick up 2 right away. Probably move on to something else. Probably not Xenogears, because I don't know that I've got time for that. Ain't nobody got time for that. But, John, speaking of things that don't take a lot of time.
Yeah, speaking of. So, in my post-Xenoblade Chronicles X stupor, you know, I just, I haven't really felt like diving into something that it takes a lot of time, you know, after 120 hours, you know.
Yeah, that weird gaming funk where you're just like, I don't want to start anything.
I am tired.
Yes.
I want to retire from video games.
Yep. I kind of took the belt and just kind of moved into semi-retirement for a while. But so, hop back on the horse a little bit, Nintendo style, as I want to do. With The Order 1886, which is a game I was always curious about, managed to pick this one up, I think, over the holidays for a grand total of $9. I think Amazon, yeah, I mean, otherwise I wouldn't even have touched it with a 10-foot pole, but Amazon had the download code for like $9, so I'm like, all right, I'll bite. So it's, I would sum this game up as never has a game looked so good and been so average. You know, I was looking up the Metacritic reviews for this game, and it pretty much got butchered by a lot of outlets. Like, I mean, there was one that I saw that gave it like a 2 out of 10 and said it was a bad game. It's not a bad game. It's just a very average game. So, like I said, it looks beautiful. It's probably one of the best-looking console games I've ever seen. But it plays more like it's tech demo-ish, just in the sense that the gameplay, it's effectively a cover shooter. But it's kind of like Uncharted Lite, but it's the same sort of gameplay where, you know, there's like a story sequence, and then you come out into a room, and the room fills with guys, and you gotta kill them all, and then you keep going. It's that kind of game. Right? To the point where, I mean, there's a few parts where I'm just like, is this really, like, there's so many, like, you have to kill so many guys before you can proceed? I was kind of like, is this glitched out? Is there something wrong here?
You mean vampire werewolves, John?
Well, yeah, there's a little bit of that too. So, you know, the game setup is that, you know, you're part of this this order of knights that serves the Queen of England or whatever. It's like steampunk London in 1886, where the story is kind of all over the place a bit, but, you know, you're part of this order of knights that I think goes back to the Knights of the Round Table. And you know, they're semi-immortal. They're not immortal, but they live hundreds of years, whatever. So you're kind of trying to figure out this conspiracy with, this is, of course, the time of the large trade companies, like East India Company, that kind of stuff. So it's kind of a conspiracy going on sort of thing. I'm not going to get too spoilery with it. But you are a character named Grayson, whose code name, they kind of, each knight on this kind of council, their code name is, you know, one of the knights of the round table. I believe Grayson, who is the main character, is Galahad. That's his code name. So I mean, you're going through and you're traversing, you know, traversing rooftops, and you know, there's a lot of quick time. A lot of the battles are, you know, they're kind of quick time kind of cutscenes, sort of like, you know, so, you know, somebody attacks you, and it kind of freezes for a second, and it shows you like the X or the O, and you have to hit that at the right time, or they kill you. It's a lot of stuff like that. And of course, that combined with the cover shooting. But the thing is, nothing is really that bad. It doesn't do anything badly, but it doesn't do anything spectacularly either. Like, everything that it takes from other games, which is, you know, almost everything, it does it in kind of a way where you're just sort of like, yeah, that was pretty cool. And, you know, I would argue that there's other games that probably do certain things worse than this game, but they're probably more fun because there are aspects of what they do that are actually really, really good. So if there's like 5 different areas to the game that could be good or bad, this does them all averagely, but none of them are really great.
This is a straight C student, is what you're saying.
Yeah, pretty much. But it's not. That's the thing. It's like I can't say it's a bad game. It's like, you know, the story is sort of interesting, but it never really reaches. But it's never really gripping. The characters are kind of interesting, but they're still sort of cliche, and you really don't get too attached to them. The gameplay is okay. It's not bad, but it's kind of very sort of rote, you know, color by numbers shooting where you come into a room, hide behind something, shoot, 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 shoot. You can swap guns, but none of them are really too different. It's just, so yeah, it's kind of blah. It's a very interesting game because I can see how people could react to it and say that it's really, really bad. It's just, it's not really, really bad. It's just that most games are either terrible or they're really good. And this game falls completely in the middle.
Well, this is...
Outside of the graphics, which are absolutely fantastic.
This is kind of a hotly occupied space, especially on Sony platforms.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Sony has a franchise that they almost annualized on this one.
Mm-hmm.
Not quite, almost.
Yeah, I mean, at the end, they leave it wide open for a sequel. So
that's not happening.
Yeah.
But, like, so if you're coming into that space, in that kind of gameplay space, that's that crowded, you really have to nail it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you come into, you know, an area that's occupied by, you know, as much as we've given the Gears games some shit for their everything about them, and you have the, you know, the very, I guess the Nathan Drake collection had come out at that point on PS4, it was about to, I can't remember. Like, you have things that live in that same space that mm-hmm. are well known, that are very good. I wonder if it's more of a situation of, this just paled in comparison in such a way that it seemed worse than it is.
Well, yeah, I think part of that, too, is the way that they hyped it up. They absolutely hyped it up, so people thought it was going to be, like, the next big series from them, sort of like the next kind of Uncharted from them, and it's definitely not that.
So, I mean, I will tell you, I went to the E3 where they were showing this,
mm-hmm.
and people at that E3 started to realize that maybe there's something about this game because it was not playable in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
They had a big theater. And you could watch video. I don't even think it was a live gameplay. You could just watch video of somebody playing it.
Mm-hmm.
And they had huge, huge signs for it all over their booth. But it wasn't actually there.
Yeah.
And I think that was the part people started going like, the fuck's going on with this thing?
Yeah, it's the kind of game, as I was playing through it, I was like, boy, this would be a great game to watch on Twitch. As I'm playing it,
I wonder
right?
if that's what happened to it.
Yeah, and it's that kind of game because it's not really. It's just I don't know. It's like the way I picture it is that they said, okay, we have this great you know, graphics engine. We have to hang a game concept on it, and we have to do it and have it shipped in like 18 months. What can we do? What can we throw out there? And, you know, they came up with this concept and said, okay, well, it'll be a cover shooter because we know how to do that. And, you know, it'll be, you know, it'll have some quick time elements. Let's go. It's like they looked at God of War and they looked at Uncharted.
Well, I mean, both, keep actually, in mind, they made two God of War games for the PSP.
They did. Yes. Ready at Dawn did. And I don't know.
And Daxter for the PSP.
Yeah. It's like, it's just, this game is very, it's very derivative. And it doesn't, and what it does isn't done, it's not done better than it is elsewhere. So.
All right, John, I got a pop quiz for you then. Can you name the non Daxter / non God of War game that they made? They also made God of War Collection for the PS3.
Oh, man. Ready at Dawn? Oh, God.
You are going to be. You give up? Anybody else want to take a shot at it?
Do you want me to buzz in? They
in.
Okami port for Wii.
They sure did!
Oh, crazy. Wow. And see, that's the thing. These guys, I mean, you can tell, they kind of, you know, they remind me of like, a company like Sheenan, where everything they do looks really great, but their game sort of lacks substance.
It doesn't feel like they can get over that hump from a gameplay design standpoint.
Yeah, it's like they nail the graphics engine first, and they just make something that looks amazing, and then they just kind of fill in the blanks with some sort of, you know, rehashed game concept.
You played one of the PSP God of War games, didn't you?
Oh yeah, I've played them all. I think.
Yeah,
I've beat some of them.
How did you feel about those? Out of curiosity.
They're good. I mean, they're good games. They look really good. They
play like God of War games.
Okay.
But they're certainly not bad, but they don't stray far from that formula. And that formula, by the time those games came out, was very much set in stone and very easy to replicate.
Gotcha.
So.
Okay.
Yeah.
$9, less than the price of a movie.
Yeah. I mean, it's worth it. It's worth playing through if you can find this game really, really cheap, just out of curiosity, because it's not a bad game. It's just kind of like you play it. I was thinking that this game, I would compare this game, I would say that Order 1886 is like the potato chips of gaming. you buy a bag and you say, boy, these chips taste really good. You go through the whole bag for, it takes you like a half an hour to go through them. They taste really good, but there's no real nutritional value or substance. And you're hungry 2 hours after you eat them and you don't really get anything out of it.
You get fat.
They're potato chips. It's not bad. Potato chips aren't really, you always enjoy eating potato chips, but ultimately it's a meaningless meal.
Wow.
There you go, man.
Meaningless meal. All right, I gotta write that one down.
Mm-hmm.
Greg.
Yep. Something I get to talk about. This was another sort of victim of Xenoblade. This one is Freedom Planet for Wii U. So I first played this in the demo that was put out during the Nindies at Home thing, which entitled me to the 15% discount, I think it was, during the first month that it was on sale here right. on the European eShop. And I took them up on that, but then proceeded not to play it because of Xenoblade for quite a few weeks. But, you know, in the aftermath, I've got to play this, and I've just finished it with the first character that I played with, which is Lilac, this sort of lilac-coloured female dragon thing. But, yeah, for those who don't know, this is a game that's been on PC before, and I guess this is the first kind of console version. But it sort of began as this Sonic-inspired game, you know, classic 2D Sonic that kind of grew a bit more into its own thing. Obviously I talked about playing Sonic 2 3D not that long ago, during last year. And so, as you may remember, I'm not the hugest fan of classic Sonic games, although I haven't played that many of them, but the feedback on this was positive, and certainly the demo experience was positive, so I was convinced to give it a go. And now, having sort of played through the game once, at least, I haven't seen everything because some of the characters have like their own specific levels, I'm rather pleased with it. I mean, I think there's a few elements in which certainly for me improves the kind of experience of that kind of gameplay that Sonic offered. It says, yeah, speed is important and so forth, and you get loop the loops and all that kind of stuff, springs, some of the zones are very clearly kind of in that Sonic vein. You've got one that'll remind you of the casino kind of environment, and certainly at the end it's going to remind you of some of the kind of Robotnik metallic fortressy kind of places you might go. But I think the biggest thing is, first of all, it's very rare in this game that I find that speed became my enemy, as I sort of complained about sometimes it might in the Sonic 2 or the original Sonic, where
right.
It's like it kind of encourages you to go fast, but then there's that time where you're just gonna crash into an enemy head on the other that's got like a drill coming out of the front of it, so you just go straight into that. In this, you don't really have to worry about jumping on enemies. Quite a number of them don't necessarily have to worry about kind of going around them either. Maybe some have spikes, but a lot of the time, you could just use sort of melee attacks while kind of passing through them to defeat them if you want. And in the case of Lilac, like, she's got a double jump, which is an attack, which is very kind of useful. So it really feels like, a lot of the time you're kind of safer if you're going at speed. And then if you want to slow down and take on some enemies and explore a bit, you've got quite a lot of latitude to do that, because, again, sort of like what I say about Sonic 2, you have got these very open levels, a lot of vertical kind of real estate, so you can poke around all these different places, and there's some things to find, like extra lives, but also like these kind of cards which go to the menu, and they'll be like the items for the sound test, artwork, that kind of stuff, these little extras. Not worth a tremendous amount in themselves, but it's just kind of interesting to see where the game designers take you with some of these little bits off the beaten track to get these extras. And then I think the area where it really kind of improved for me, or delivered a lot more as an experience than the Sonic games I've played, is the bosses, because they're a lot more interesting. A lot of the time with Sonic bosses that I've played, what happens is you kind of get tied down. Having been, really fast and all that, you get tied down into this single screen environment and then just very carefully kind of jumping around, avoiding stuff. And it just feels kind of at odds with the rest of the experience. Whereas with these, a lot of the time, the boss, you'll find yourself in quite a big area and you might actually be encouraged to run around this, big, loop, essentially, as part of fighting the boss. Kind of evading its attacks or keeping up with it to do damage, and really huge things in some cases. Massive, multi-segmented, rotating, very treasure-esque sprite work on these bosses. In many ways, it's going for a 16-bit look, a Mega Drive type look for obvious reasons. But, at that point, it's much more like kind of Treasure's 32-bit stuff. That you might have seen on the Saturn or something like that. And it's just the designs for the bosses are really quite cool. They start to really show their teeth a bit towards the end. A lot of the game I went through and I was never really in any danger of an actual game over, running out of lives. But although it's super generous with checkpoints, so that those aren't really meaningful anyway. But towards the end, some of those bosses are really quite tough. And like I said, you are... At that point, it feels it's quite intense. Using all these melee attacks at your disposal to sort of get as many hits in as you can, and maybe quite a small window before it might launch some really devastating attacks and stuff. And just the fact that you can kind of use the speed in the boss battles, in the one where you're pursuing this sort of great holographic projection of a dragon. And you have to kind of follow it along to take off these red scales that are on its back and stuff. It's really, really fun. Certainly, my most enjoyable Sonic type of experience that I've had, personally, which, it doesn't necessarily mean a great deal because I'm not the biggest sort of aficionado of his games, but I was really pleased with this. Like I said, some of it was just, because of the reviews and the feedback and the price, with the discounts, it wasn't necessarily something I had a great personal expectations for, but what expectations I did have, I quite comfortably exceeded.
That's actually kind of a promising thing to hear, because I actually own this game.
Oh, really?
I haven't used it.
More another victim of Xenoblade.
Yeah, more or less. So it was... I growing up, as much as I beat Sonic characters to death, because they deserve it, there is something about 3 that when I played it when I was a lot younger at a friend's house that I really liked. And I thought, well... People seem really, really up on this game, and I didn't get the discount because I was busy covering E3 while they were doing it.
You were not at home.
So I was at home. I was doing the site's E3 coverage.
Well, yeah, true, but you know what I mean. You weren't just dilly-dallying around to playing stuff. You had to,
I ended 11 podcasts that week. It's something absurd. Something completely nonsensical like that, so I never got around to doing it. But I was concerned it may ever be sentenced to the dustbin of history on my Wii U, but I guess I'll give it a shot now because.
Well, one thing I'll say, I said that I guess it's obviously going to sort of prick my ears up, but just how kind of that the Sonic stuff is really obvious, and there's certain things with the music, but just that additional layer of treasure.
Yeah,
angle is kind of what really sort of pleased me, because there is a part where you almost fight Seven Force from Gunstar. It's a pretty clear reference.
So I was actually hearing Dynamite Heady.
Obviously Dynamite Heady is the treasure platformer on the Mega Drive. So right. There's definitely some of that, you could say. I think that there's some of them, but just that seemed like the most overt reference when you fight a boss where, it's a chase sequence, the background's whizzing past, it's green, it starts changing its shape a lot, it's pretty overt. But like I said, there's just a general feel about the boss, even the ones that aren't like that naked about it, that that kind of channels some of that spirit. And that's a good thing. The very few people who are better sort of exponents of the art of boss making than Treasure. So I think it's, if you're going to kind of crib from anyone, they're the boys to crib from.
Yeah. No, that's pretty cool.
So, music's really good. I enjoyed that. You know, so it's got a little bit of that FM kind of synth feel to it in places, you know, to channel that Mega Drive Genesis feel. But at the same time, at least to my ears, mercifully, it doesn't take that too far. You know, because I am not a fan of that sound, but, you know, being kind of faithfully reproduced. And it's actually quite a lush soundtrack. And it's got a really catchy kind of main theme that it weaves into quite a number of components of it, like the invincibility song and stuff, really nice.
Cool. All right, well, I guess that's going to do it for new business. We'll be back after the break with your listener mail. It's Now Playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. New business is back. You probably gained that from the intro that was right before this. I forget that intro is there sometimes.
New Hi, John. Are Now Playing.
Now Playing is back. I forget the name of it sometimes because it's been a long time. And really, the names don't make sense. They probably should be reversed.
Well, James, I got your back, buddy.
Thank you, John. It's good to have you back, John.
Yeah, it's good to be back.
Except for that joke that you're going to have in the second segment that basically just ruins the show. But that's fine. It's fine. Everything's fine. Because we have new content on GeneralReport.com, including, first up this week, a preview of Fire Emblem Fates on 3DS. Fire Emblem Fates is looking great, and Curtis and Aaron had some hands-on time with it, as well as a playthrough with quote-unquote Nintendo rep. That sounds shady. And deliver you a ton of details on the battle system, multiplayer, amiibo functionality. Find out why Fates is, quote, the game that shouldn't have happened.
Da-da-da-da.
That's kind of a hard way to describe your game. I mean, I would describe that, like, there's probably a Neptunia game that probably shouldn't have been the game that should have happened.
There's a lot of games that shouldn't have happened, and we probably talked about them on the show.
I mean, Sonic Boom definitely shouldn't have happened.
Yeah, I mean, there's some questionable content out there, James. A lot of it is on our podcast, too.
A lot of it is our podcast.
Mm-hmm.
We also have a review of Final Fantasy Explorers, also on 3DS, because the 3DS RPG machine never stops.
And nobody makes games for Wii U.
Nobody. Remember the good old days of Final Fantasy, when the series was really great? Well, you don't have to remember anymore because Square Enix reminds you of it with every game release. The newest entry in the the newest entry in Final Fan Service series is Explorers, which is sort of like Monster Hunter, with less depth, but more Final Fantasy. Because you want some Final Fantasy in your Final Fantasy.
Final Fan Service, buddy.
Thank you, Exhibit.
All right, and we have a preview of Bravely Second on 3DS, of course, because who makes Wii U games these days?
who makes non-RPGs on 3DS?
Yep. Don Koopman, Herr Koopman is back, and this time he has a heaping helping of Bravely Second information for you. My main takeaway from this preview is that I somehow didn't play the first game, despite the fact that there's a faction called the Ball Busters. I also feel a certain shame that I didn't think of that pun myself. I had to look up the word ball.
It's B-A apostrophe A-L.
Yeah, and actually I didn't know what that meant.
It's a god from Mesopotamia area.
Yeah, from the days of antiquity.
Yes.
Ball busters.
Yeah.
That's good stuff.
That's Ready for Nintendo in a nutshell right there.
It is. All right. And we have a feature, 2016 predictions. 100% guaranteed accurate. That's how we do predictions around here. Justin, Donald, and Matt take another turn on the perfection train as they promise you things like a new F-Zero title and Metroid Federation Force being a quote-unquote good game.
Oh, God!
Again, 100% guaranteed money in the bank.
I didn't ask for this!
You got it, buddy.
This isn't what I signed up for!
Yep. Oh.
I predict you can find more content like this, but probably also equally inaccurate predictions, right now at NintendoWorldReport.com. And we're back. I gotta find a new way to start this segment, because I say "and we're back" every time just because I heard Johnny do it for 300 episodes.
And we're back! Something like that.
Find your own identity, James.
Yeah, find your... I can't speak for you, James. Lord knows I will, but...
I'm sure. I mean, considering you just went straight up like Super Smash TV on us.
Hey, I mean, whatever works, man.
Big money, big prizes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's listener mail. This is the second segment of the show. It's where we traditionally do listener mail. And you can send us listener mail to do on the show to RFN at NintendoWorldReport.com. For those of you who are new to the internet, that's an email address. You put it in an email client and it sends to you. I don't think the kids know what email clients are. You put it in the email in your web browser and it sends to us and we read it on the show. And you got a pretty good chance of getting on the show if you send it because we've got some stuff in the backlog. Some of it's maybe gotten a little old and some of it's maybe not the most relevant anymore. But if you send it, there's a decent chance we'll get on the show because we know there's more of you out there listening and send emails. And if you really love us, you'll send emails. Like this one.
Brett writes, "Hey kids, if you're not too sick of discussing RPGs, I could use a little advice on a weird question. I've been getting really into Shin Megami Tensei games, and have recently played through Strange Journey, Shin Megami Tensei 4, and Devil Survivor Overclocked. With Shin Megami Tensei 4 Final coming this year, and wanting a bit of a break before it comes out, I'm wondering if you could recommend a good Pokemon game for the interim. I've never really played Pokemon, but it seems mechanically similar, and an SMT-like game that's a bit easier, a bit lighter, a bit shorter would be great at the moment. Any tips? I'm not necessarily asking for the best Pokemon game, but for the best Pokemon for an SMT fan." So, yeah, I've played some Shin Megami Tensei games, and I'm not that into Pokemon, but I gotta just start out by saying that Shin Megami Tensei is... There are some similarities, because you build a party of monsters to fight for you, but where Shin Megami Tensei 4, you really don't get attached to your monsters because you keep fusing them together to create new ones and to keep their abilities and to get them more powerful. In Pokemon, you're really just training... I don't know. You find the ones that you want and you keep training them to build them up. Like, it's more grindy that way, no?
Yeah, although I guess you get the breeding with two Pokemon and then you get an egg and something. I guess that's where you get into the really kind of granular stuff with getting the best possible kind of stats or something that goes way over the head of my experience of Pokemon. And presumably right. Outside of the kind of play style that's being looked for here from Brett.
The thing that is a little bit different, you kind of hit the point, because a lot of the Pokemon have a ceiling. You know, there is a, but in SMT games, there is a hard ceiling. Like, at some point, you need to switch out from the ones you've been using.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't have anywhere else to go. Like, they sort of maxed out what they can do, and they're no longer... They are really only approachable as ingredients at this point.
Right.
Whereas in Pokemon, there is some of that. There are some Pokemon that, you know, you can't take them all the way to the Elite Four. Like, they're just not... They're not suited for the task. But in general, you can level them up, and most can be competitive. They may have to be a lot higher level than some other more powerful ones just to kind of do the work, but you could get them there. So the question is, how much does it need to be a Pokemon game? And that seems like a weird question, I understand. So I'm curious why Brett is interested explicitly in Pokemon.
You okay, Watch?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I knew that's where you were going.
So here's thing. Yo-Kai Watch is way SMT. It's much closer. It includes right down to the ability to, you know, take two creatures that eventually, a lot of the creatures do have a point where they're diminishing returns. They're not useful anymore.
Plus, it's got like the inappropriate body parts kind of respect to it. Like, you've got a butt monster, right? So
you do.
you goes do a, hand in do, hand, so to speak, with
two
the
butt monsters.
Yeah, with the penis chariot monsters from SMT.
There you go. It is definitely it's shorter. It's shorter than a Pokemon game. Like you can mainline that game and actually pick up most of the monsters in about 20-ish hours, like all told. It's not super involved from a combat standpoint, but you know it is what it is. I thought it was kind of a laugher of a game. You know, it doesn't require you to explore a big world like Pokemon. You spend a lot of time in transit between places. It's just a pretty small world that's just densely populated. There's definitely some stuff in there that's kind of like doesn't necessarily help you out where you're trying to get to. But at this point, with the game having been out for a little while, most of those questions have been answered. Versus when I played, where most of the answers were out there, but they were in Japanese, using the Japanese names for stuff. So you were like, well, I don't know who this character is they're talking about or what I'm looking for or whatever. So it's kind of similar to Pokemon, but it does lean more heavily on SMT stuff. It's kind of a jokey SMT game. The other one I would recommend is, this is actually kind of a not a Pokemon game in the mainline series. I would actually say something more like the... what was the Nobunaga's Ambition Pokemon game?
Conquest, was it? Pokemon Conquest?
Yeah, it's not really SMT related in any real conceivable way, but it is a more kind of... It's a little bit of a less straightforward game. It's not so much just like, you know, here's your monsters, you grind them up, you take them out in the battle. Obviously, I'm not denigrating the fact that in Pokemon you can get as deep into that system as you want to. You know, you can go do EV training or whatever stuff you feel like doing if you really want to get the full developmental Pokemon experience. It's just it's designed to be approachable in a way that Nobunaga's Ambition Pokemon is not. It's Pokemon Conquest. So if you want to see something maybe a little bit still incredibly stupid, because you see things like a Pikachu running around in samurai armor, but it's a little bit.
He's enjoying the cosplay these days, isn't he, Pikachu? He's got the luchador thing going on in the Pokken tournament. He's got the Deerstalker detective thing going on in the Pikachu detective game. And then, of course, he was already a samurai warrior.
yeah. Well, and he has a new voice, which is even better. So
yeah, that's a little more extreme. Is it like the collars in Up? Do we think?
Yes. I mean, it's hard because we were talking about this before we started this segment. We don't have the most up-to-date experience with the Pokemon franchise. There's something about that franchise that I'm speaking for myself, and you guys can sort of address it, that they're not the same. And it's not fair to those games to call them the same. But they are a very the mainline franchise is very iterative. So... If the question is there one of those that getting into is better than the others? I can't say. I mean, there if you want to see the more retro stuff, you could wait for the Game Boy Virtual Console ones to come out. But if you want to see like all the bells and whistles as they exist now, you might as well just go buy X and Y.
Right.
But I would think that if you want to see something, if you want to see something different, maybe one of the spin-offs is more in the area. There's a couple different series that are Pokemon related that I don't want to talk about. I can't talk about them.
Mystery Dungeon, you mean?
But you mean Pokemon Ranger? Yeah, let's talk about Pokemon Ranger.
No jokes. Mystery Dungeon. It still hasn't come out yet over here. You know, you got to get excited for that.
You go play that and then tell us how it was.
What I saw from the game, the Super Mystery Dungeons American reception was that it was something of an improvement over previous Pokemon Mystery Dungeon games. But I guess that's more of like a sort of entry level game. Like if you was talking about Etrian Mystery Dungeon,
right?
In terms of Atlas's catalog, as opposed to as opposed to SMT,
yeah.
Although, obviously, the games he references kind of span genres a little bit. Like Devil Survivor is a tactical game, right?
So, right, and that Pokemon Conquest is more in that vein.
Yeah, that's kind of the one-for-one there. Yeah.
Anybody else have thoughts?
Well, I just because the question was so much about Pokemon, I'm not qualified. I played Fire Red back in the day, and that was it.
Well, I would say to open up a little bit, maybe games that are lighthearted, maybe mechanically simple, not necessarily Pokemon.
Well, like specifically shorter RPGs, there's not a ton of them that I can think of offhand. Like, go get into Chrono Trigger, maybe, or
what about the Dragon Suikoden? Quest monsters stuff?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I've never played any of those. Joker. Obviously, I don't think we've in America and Europe got some of the most recent ones necessarily that promptly or stuff. But I mean, those games, there was certainly a number of them on DS and. I've never had the pleasure, but I imagine that's another alternative to Pokemon. If for any reason, you weren't sure that Pokemon was actually going to scratch the itch, but I mean, it's been a while since I played as well. I played Diamond and Pearl and then Soul Silver Heart Gold, so not the most recent, but I mean, Silver and Gold I think is a pretty good entry point. You know, the big world that you end up getting and. The sort of range of monsters is pretty good, and I mean, I'm no Pokemon expert, but I think that's probably as good a time, good a sort of place to get in as any.
Sure.
If you did want to go back in time a little bit before, it was quite as sort of populous in terms of the number of monsters as it is today. And of course, if you got a DS cut of the remakes, that'll still go in your 3DS.
Yep. The biologists of the Pokemon world were absolute shit, is the best I can describe it. The Dragon Quest Monsters games, they are somewhat derisively referred to as Pokemon clones, but they are different. So that there is.
So those games were on the Joker ones were on the DS, and they're still they're not too hard to find. You can get them for $10 on Amazon.
And there is a new Joker one coming out this year, I think. Joker 3.
Is that being localized though?
It's not out in Japan yet, so I don't know.
Right, probably not.
Probably not. But they did do. I don't think they've done one since 2010. Joker 2. So, yeah, I mean, but to your point, it's fairly easy to get a hold of. So, could be worth looking at. All right, I'm gonna read the next email, and it is Dan. From Canada writes, "Hey guys, I was just wondering if you guys think there will be paid DLC for Mario Maker that similar to the paid DLC for Mario Kart and Smash Brothers. I'm thinking something more substantial than amiibo skins. If yes, what would you like to see, and what do you think we will see? Thanks, and as always, love the show."
Tricky one, this one.
There's
scope for it, naturally. We've touched on it a little bit last week with reference to the e-reader components in the Super Mario Advance 4, Super Mario Bros. 3. there are elements of Mario games that are missing that you could put in there. Conceivably, they could kind of bundle some of that stuff together. Maybe along with some new things or whatever, and then charge people for that. But I don't know. It's I guess it's a bit of a how would that divide the player base exactly? Would you be able to play though? People,
I think
those,
you'd have to be
would,
able to.
Would you be able to play those levels even if you hadn't bought the pack? Or would there be almost like a bit of a free rider problem in play there, where it's like, well, people who make levels. Are kind of left to have to buy it while all the freeloaders enjoy the fruits of it or something. It's a little bit different from some of the issues that we've seen with Nintendo's other DLC ventures.
I think the only thing that would make sense would be something like a tournament mode. Like maybe you could play other people and they could just give you kind of like a riff on the whole challenge mode where, you could get tossed into a tournament bracket and you would have to play through these 10 courses. And you would play somebody else, something like that. It would be another way to reuse what courses are already there, like just kind of a remix of that.
Yeah, but I don't know how you would sell that as DLC. That's the tricky part.
Yeah,
because exactly. The thing is, I think people have become so conditioned that DLC is content and assets and not necessarily modes.
Yeah,
that it would. I mean, Nintendo's been guilty of this themselves. They've been giving out modes for games as a service now for over a year.
Mm-hmm.
So people may look at that and go, well, this is the kind of thing we usually get for free, so what the F?
Yeah, unless it was like, it was, you know, Nintendo created, you know, stuff where, you know, like actual, like almost like a new Mario game made with the assets that are already in there and maybe adding some new assets in there along with it. I don't know. That's the only thing I could see people buying.
Yeah, I think the idea that, I think what Greg's touched on here is kind of important. You could definitely, if you were to make a new pack, we understand why Mario 2 is not in the game. Like there are mechanical reasons why Mario 2 would be very difficult to pull off in the Mario Maker structure. You could do it, but it would be significantly more involved than any of the other level sets, just because Mario 2 isn't a Mario game, ultimately. Our Mario 2, Doki Doki Panic. It's a little bit difficult to adapt that into the gameplay engine, I would imagine. You could just do it aesthetically, but I don't know you'd be able to sort of recreate what makes that game unique.
Right, but yet, I don't know, they kind of halfway did it in the Super Mario Brothers Advance 4, because, yeah, like you can pull veggies out of the ground and chuck them. Of course, like they didn't change other stuff. Like you can't just jump on the back of an enemy and pick them up and, you know, throw them at other enemies.
Yeah, like how much would you have to? I suppose that's the thing. I mean, if you were going to do like an extra pack that was paid content and whatever, you probably would have to go more the whole hog and say, okay, this is, you know, like more substantively like Mario 2 rather than just like, okay, it's a few elements of Mario 2, you know, so like, you know, really kind of the stuff you remember from that game, like James, you jump on an enemy and, or, you know, the whole
potions.
Thing with, the potions and the doors and all that kind of stuff like that. That to me would be maybe, you know, so, but then, like you said, that might, I'm not sure whether it's worth the trouble or not in terms of like how much, because that's the thing. It's just that, you know, the way Mario Maker is, you're not running out of things to play, I guess.
Right.
But
right.
It is good. It would have to probably be more focused on the content creators, you know,
which I think is fine. I think creating is such kind of a rush in that game that you could, I would say actually letting people play those stages, even if you made it so, when you hadn't unlocked all the content in the game, you could take a stage that had them into the editor and play with them and save them. But I think they would have to put a hard lock that says if this is based on that tile set, you can't open the... Well, maybe you can open the editor and look at it, but you can't save it or something like that. Like, so
That sounds so frustrating, though. Like, if you're... Well, like, lots of kids are playing it, and...
It'll say, buy the effing level pack, yo.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
I don't know, like, how do you do paid DLC in a level creator kind of thing?
I mean,
usually you would go the aesthetic route and, like, look, you can give this costume to this character, but they've been doing that with Amiibo.
Which is what, and also that's what Dan is saying, you know, he's asking if there's something more substantive than that. And they've been doing that for free as well with the event courses where, you know, Captain Toad pixel costume and all the others, you know, the Famitsu mascot or whatever. You know,
right, maybe that's the route. Like, instead of making us pay for DLC, they're getting sponsorships, and so we've got Mario in a car.
Yeah,
we've got Mercedes-Benz, we've got Southwest Airlines, you know, that kind of stuff. Like, that's, they're kind of monetizing it, mm-hmm. you know, but without actually, you know, for getting the end user to pony up.
I mean, John's idea of here's a bunch of levels we made is pretty cool, but as you said, there's no end to content in this game, and somebody could immediately turn around and just recreate all those levels.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there could be. So it would be interesting if there's like, okay, here's a new way to kind of exploit this huge well of levels. You know, whether it's a tournament structure, whatever it might be. But again, like you said, I think given people's expectations, like, you know, you said, I think the key words assets, content, you know, that kind
right.
of. Yeah, I'm not sure whether that would actually, you know, pull in a lot of sales unless it was priced really low. I mean, I personally, if I was going to guess, I'm not convinced that we'll get outright pay DLC major update on Mario Maker. What we might get, you know, we've talked about the possibility before about Mario Maker kind of getting ported / relaunched for NX. And, you know, maybe that version could have sort of more components to it that almost could have been in a DLC kind of pack for this game, but instead it'll be used as a carrot for maybe people to double dip on that version. You know, if and when that comes. You know, today we had the rumors about, you know, Smash Brothers possibly being a launch title. You know, these, we've had the email on this before about, you know, these games getting a kind of second life on NX. You know, and I think that's probably more likely than like a substantial pay deal. So I wouldn't rule out, you know, something that you know, takes money, but I think it might be more on the frivolous side, which is not what Dan's really interested in. And it does seem like they've found a sort of a model for that already, to be honest, with the event courses. So yeah, I'd say maybe the deluxe Super Mario Maker or something might have like some of the things you might look for, like, you know, a new theme, as if you've drawn from a different game, or, you know, that kind of thing.
I would like to see how they would try to adapt to into this. I mean, because they've got things like the hidden doors now, and things, switches make them show up. So, like, there's some stuff that maybe they could kind of cheese it a little bit, but yeah, I just don't see them putting the effort in.
I mean, outside of a whole theme or all that, I mean, some of the things I could imagine you could do, I mean, like, a boss pack, for instance. You know, I mean, at the minute, you know, you've got Bowser Jr., you can make enemies bigger and, like, stack them on top of each other and make these sort of nightmare creatures or whatever. But, you know, bring it back, like, more bosses from the other games, or maybe even create ones that are a bit different. You have the Koopa Kids in their various guises and things like that. Like, just, you know, I don't think you could sell it for much, but you could probably do it. You know, and maybe it's like, okay, but again, like, I guess maybe just target more at those people that have created a lot of levels and are kind of like looking for an excuse to create more.
Right.
might, like, you know, part with a bit of their money to, you know, find a different sort of big bad to put at the end of their level.
Yeah, there's definitely stuff that I'd like to see in the game, but there's so much stuff already in terms of elements that I don't know. I don't know how cheap they'd have to make it to get me to pay. Like, probably pretty cheap. So I don't know. Yeah. Of course, it's hard to predict what it means, what the NX means for the porting, because we have this conversation every time. We don't know what the NX is. So
you need the sort of TYP to do a cut up, sped up version of that disclaimer that we could just sort of insert at will
every time it's relevant. Because. You know, I saw some chatter following this. The fact that Namco Bandai is making a bunch of games for NX shouldn't surprise anybody. Namco Bandai and Nintendo are so deep in bed at this point that it's not surprising. But the idea that, oh, you don't, some people were going, well, Mario Maker should be on the NX even if there's no gamepad like device, because it's easy enough to do it. Look at what's the PlayStation series.
The Little Big Planet.
Look at Little Big Planet. You could do that with the cursor. And then the response was, Little Big Planet's terrible. So, like, it's so vital to have that device that lets you make this work. It's what makes it fun, that, I don't know. So insert our disclaimer here about not knowing what the NX is.
Well, I mean, let me just say, you know, obviously one of those, you know, Namco games is Ridge Racer. That's what they're not telling you.
I don't know if they made a Ridge Racer in a decade.
It's coming.
There was a 3DS launch.
Oh, that's right, you're right. And there was a Vita one too, I believe.
Well, get ready.
PSP or Vita, like, it was, what was it? Ridge Racer Unbounded?
Unbounded.
Unbounded, wow. Yeah. They went the revengeance route.
Called Raul Julia in it, posthumously?
NX launch game, Ridge Racer Unleashed. That's my prediction right there. There you go. That's a free prediction. You don't have to pay for that.
Ridge Racers. The Z at the end.
Ridge Racer Cross something. Cross Monster Hunter, probably.
Oh, no. It's Project Racer Zone. Done. We're out. All the cars are weird, like, character representations of other franchises that talk way too much. Jeez. All right, this email's gone off the deep end.
Yeah.
Next email, John.
All right. GX writes, Dear RFN crew, with Nintendo World Store closing for renovations and rebranding, I've heard multiple people infer that because the new name is Nintendo New York, we could see other regional Nintendo stores. While I don't buy that Knievel-esque leap of logic, they're obviously closing to fit all of their salespeople with rabbit suits. Does it raise the question, will a line of Nintendo stores make sense? Microsoft and Apple have stores, but they have a wider range of high-end things to sell. Lego and Disney have stores, but their brands still hold more universal cachet than Nintendo. It would be a good opportunity to keep the Nintendo brand visible in a controlled mainstream way, but does that in itself justify the cost of space rental, staffing, and upkeep? Does Nintendo have enough diverse products to sell?
Before we get into answering this question, GX just asked a fucking marketing question and nailed it. Nice job, sir.
Right, like, is there something left to answer here?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot.
I feel like he pretty much covered it.
There's a lot to talk about, but he unpacked that topic beautifully.
Yeah. I mean, Nintendo is a fairly... I think Nintendo is just as universal a brand as Lego, Disney. Maybe not Disney. Lego, definitely. I'd say they're bigger than them, I would think.
Lego's got that fan base that's like, yeah, I'll buy this $400 Millennium Falcon Lego kit.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
Doesn't Lego true. Have some sort of relationship with Warner Brothers, and like Batman is almost a Lego character now?
Yeah. It's weird. Yeah. Yep.
Well, you know, it's funnily enough, just to give a quick story for those who haven't been listening to the show particularly long, sitting on top of my dresser is a bunch of Lego minifigures that we made during one of the PAX trips at a Lego store, representing each of us on the show.
Mm-hmm.
I think we stole one actually by accident.
Yeah,
which is we stuck four in a three person container, and the guy's like, yeah, I don't care, whatever, just take it.
Yeah, it was it prompted a very awkward aside at the start.
It did,
of one of our panels.
It wasn't my idea. It was foisted upon me. Mm-hmm. But yes, I pulled out the start of the panel. So if you haven't seen those, actually, you can go see one of the PAX panels. That was the last one we did, I think.
I can't.
It should be like 2012, 2013.
I've tried to forget, to be honest with you. But
yeah, it was a weird thing that we did. But yeah, so the Lego stores are kind of interesting because they sell stuff that's not easy to get elsewhere. The Disney store is kind of the same way. So the Disney store stocks a lot of merchandise, but they stock such a you know, if you go to a toy store or a department store, there's going to be a lot of Disney merchandise there. But it's generally speaking, kind of a narrow band focus on what's currently hot.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to a Toys R Us right now, there's going to be about a half of an aisle plus devoted to Star Wars.
Yeah.
There's going to be
random aside. My favorite bit of Star Wars merchandise from the Blitz so far is a birthday card from a son to a dad featuring Kylo Ren with his lightsaber drawn. I'll just leave it there.
That's pretty great.
Oh, that's terrible.
Can you imagine opening that? It's just like, is there something you want to talk about?
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Who in their right mind? All right, anyway.
Microsoft and Apple... makes sense for them to have their own stores just because they have big, you know, they have a wide range of products that all interact with each other, ecosystems and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think the challenge on the Apple store is that they're generally speaking overstaffed. And
yeah.
I don't know that their good costs, that the cost benefit on an Apple store as it's currently constituted makes a ton of sense.
Yeah.
But
they also have a lot of products that would need kind of hands-on support as well.
They do, but I've never found that their hands-on support was particularly...
I'm not saying what they're doing is good. I'm just saying you can justify it more so than Nintendo that has really a console and a handheld.
Well, and merch. It depends on how crazy they want to get with the merch, because the Disney store works well and the Lego store work well because, unlike these sort of broadly focused retailers who have much bigger floor space but
mm-hmm.
have to squeeze in all the other brand du jours onto the toy shelves.
Yeah.
Onto the movie sections and into the, you know, video game section. They can do a much more, you know, deep dive on their merchandise. So on that same trip where we bought the Lego minifigures, I was there with Carly at that mall. I can't remember what that mall was called, Boston. It's a huge, huge mall. And
South Shore Plaza?
They had like this very specific character from the Aristocats that she liked, and like, it was like, I don't see, and they had like six different size plushes of this cat, whereas you may not even be able to find one of those in a regular store. So like, they can be much more focused on their brand and offer much more of a variety of products.
And bear in mind, Sony also used to have Sony stores,
but I think they
closed them all down though.
Yeah, they did. But so I would say that when Microsoft first had a Microsoft store, because Actually, that mall may have been the first time I saw one. It was not good. Like, it was nice inside, but it didn't seem to have any clarity of focus.
Well, that was probably the time when they were just, like, straight up aping Apple and everything they did and just trying to chase them.
It was pre-Surface, but it was post-Windows 8.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so, like, they had, like, a Kinect set up on 360, and they're like, you could stand in front of this Kinect. And, like, they had set it up right inside the store, so when you walked by, you got to see the thing freak out because the Kinect's actually a terrible piece of hardware.
Yep.
And then, like, there was, like, Windows 8, it's on your phone, it's on your computer, it's on your tablet. I'm like, no, Microsoft, no, you don't want this. Please don't do this to yourself. And they had, like, a whole section of, like, here's your Microsoft TruePoint mouse. And it's like...
Yeah, but that's the thing. Stores make sense for them because they're trying to sell you all that stuff and try to get you in.
See, I would argue at this point for Microsoft, as they're stepping away from the hardware somewhat, it doesn't necessarily make as much sense for them. I think what they've done is they've pivoted and made it more showing off their partners' devices. So really, it's more of a platform demo space. So I think it doesn't necessarily make sense as a retail entity. I think it makes more sense as a marketing device. But then you have to kind of put those in places where they're going to get high traffic. And I think that's maybe where you start to pivot towards, does a Nintendo store make sense if you approach it more as a marketing thing and less as a retail, as a direct-to-retail opportunity?
Kind of prestige-ish, I think it could be, you know, if you're having it in maybe just a few scattered across, you know, some of the biggest cities in the world, you know. Obviously, you've already got New York covered, but, you know, London, LA, that kind of stuff. I mean, that could make some sense. I mean, where Nintendo is now is presumably quite different from where they want to be in a while. We've heard about all the licensing opportunities that they want to embrace. And then there's the question of what their hardware business is going to be like in once the NX comes online and what that's going to be. You know, if they're envisioning themselves kind of more like Apple in that, you know, they're going to have this whole family of devices and, you know, they're going to have these kind of power users that, like, buy all of them and have, like, you know, the fancy Dan version of it exclusive to that store that's, you know, in one of the major cities or something. Like, I guess I could see it happening.
It's like
a
scarf. Yeah. Many necks will go cold this winter.
You know, I think, you know, there's probably enough demand for some of that stuff to make it somewhat viable. Right? So I would assume it would, you know, be pretty limited to start with. And then, you know, it would, any expansion would be a function of how well their sort of forays into some of these other areas actually go. Beyond Amiibo and all, you know, obviously, you know, it's already happening to some extent, but presumably it's going to be happening. The pace of it is actually going to accelerate sometime in the near future.
So let's say they signed the theme park deal with Universal, right? I'm blanking on something. Yeah. So let's say they open up. So there's Universal Studios in Japan. There's one in California, there's one in Florida. I don't know if there's any others. I can't remember. But let's say they get a footprint area of the park that's theirs. You have to imagine there's going to be a fairly substantially marked up also Nintendo retail space in that area. Because, I mean, it seems like most roller coasters...
It's like you're giving money away if you don't do that.
Right. Like, roller coasters are designed as lines to get into the gift shop. So... It makes sense there to kind of build these on their freestanding. And I think you're right about maybe putting them in some places where they align with major cities. So maybe you could do one in LA, maybe you could do one in, like, Chicago, and you could do one in Japan. In Japan, actually, there are stores already that sort of fill that need. Maybe not a singularly focused Nintendo store, but, you know, they had the old Pokemon centers in Japan. Like, there's more opportunity there for them to get you stuff at retail. So you can put one in London or whatever. But I think where they can kind of do a half step here is at least in the US, the big box retailer Best Buy, very actively in 2013, I think, maybe 2014, early 2014, announced they had too much floor space. They, you know, their business was being eaten into, and they had built these big stores, especially because they were trying to push out the other competition in the big box electronics retail space. So they were trying to build these sort of cathedrals to product so that they could essentially just crush, you know, competitors like Circuit City and Fry's by having just this this experience when you walked in. But the net effect of that was once they won, they realized they had an enemy they couldn't deal with in the internet who was just eating their lunch. And they very actively began a campaign of essentially leasing out space inside their stores to other retailers. So both Apple and Samsung have set up stores in most big Best Buys, usually right next to each other, where they sort of themed an area of the store very much in, you know, the iconography of that brand. So the Apple part looks like it's a fingerprint magnet, you know, glossy white metal. The Samsung one is kind of, you know, it's a little bit more, it's like Blade Runner representation of Apple. And then they actually, some of them actually have a Google space, which is, I don't know how to describe it. Usually it's like parquet floors and weird color schemes and stuff like that. There it seems like there's an opportunity here for Nintendo to set up these sort of almost pop-up shop style things inside retail spaces like that. So they could maybe pick up a spot of the Best Buy area and do that. And in fact, they've already kind of done that because at Target locations, they've re-schemed a lot of the Nintendo space. You know, it used to be divided Wii, 3DS, Wii U, 3DS, Wii U, 3DS. And they've sort of re-schemed them in a lot of ways, just be around the Nintendo stuff. So all your amiibo are there, your various console units are there, the games are all sort of co-mingling together. So you've got, in some cases, they have DS games they can't sell because they're terrible. Sort of all living on the shelf space together. It's not themed, it's just sort of cohabitating, and they just sort of put the singular branding over them. It seems like there's a lot of free space in retail, in big box retail, because business isn't what it used to be, that you could go put these in there as supplements to the much larger experiences that maybe they're more for, you know, taking pilgrimage to.
Well, assuming big box retail actually wants to play ball, because, I mean, the Best Buys that I've gone to, all the Wii stuff is like, yeah, we're going to find the crappiest part on our floor,
but
and
see,
we're just going to stuff that stuff there.
Nintendo pays a rent, essentially.
They'd be paying for the privilege, and it might give them better space. I suppose the other thing is it may depend. That might be more imperative, dependent on, you know, how their fortunes go in this next cycle.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean, their games haven't been selling, so that's why Best Buy is like, we don't really care.
And then I suppose the other thing
is
just that, you know, you've still that sort of direction of travel, that trend of, you know, retail getting its role being kind of diminished is very much going to carry forward into the future. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as I said, I think that is another thing that kind of mitigates against them having like a whole bunch of stores at some point.
Right.
You said, I mean, it's something that's more kind of they could walk away from more easily, like, you know, kind of a presence in some other retailer stores is maybe they could do that. But like, it's not the way the wind's blowing. I think prestige stores in big cities, the theme park stuff, yes, maybe whatever other tie-ins to licenses stuff that might come along. And like I said, I mean, if we get to a point where there's, you know, Nintendo cartoons or animated movies or all that, like, they could have enough stuff to fill these stores. Like, that could, I wouldn't necessarily think it's a good fit now, kind of as GX alludes to, but it could be if things go the way they want to. But that's kind of execution dependent, as well as just, you know, maybe they've got to get a bit of good luck, you know, to good marketing, whatever else, to get all these kind of other ventures off the ground that they could, you know, fill a store like that and you know, have people kind of make it like that pilgrimage kind of angle. Like, yeah, you know, I want to go there and get the kind of the as you said, the kind of the deeper cuts Nintendo stuff.
Yeah, I mean,
I think there's enough love of Nintendo out there amongst certain households that could happen.
Of the Big Eight,
if they if they leverage it well enough one day, but I don't think it's there yet.
Yeah, but you gotta have a product that will drive traffic there. Like, you can't. I don't think you're gonna interest people by having a sleek table to show off NX. Like, you're gonna need something that people want.
What if that was the first place where you could play the NX?
Yeah, it would have to be something. It would have to be. Or it would have to be a space to do unique stuff in.
But yeah. if it's got like you know, we don't know what the NX is, but if it's got like a dual analog controller, like. Okay, sure, it's the first place play the NX, but that's only going to draw Nintendo fans.
Sure. Yeah, no, you're right. But I think this kind of unique boutique experience, there you go. Maybe that's the episode title. I think that's who you're going for. You're not trying to win converts there necessarily in the opening salvo. You're trying to bring in people who are going to drop fat cash so they can get their Waluigi plushie because they're monsters.
But also generate buzz. I mean, I would think that the whole point of it would be to raise Nintendo's profile.
Sure, right? I think that
yeah,
comes...
GX talks about cachet, you know, to sort of like maintain and perhaps expand that. I could see it being part of a strategy, but I think they've got a lot of building to do with this kind of, you know, branching out that they're planning before they'd get to a point where that would really kind of fit in to their, you know, actually bothering to do this in, you know, a number of the larger cities around the world.
Yeah, but I think they are going to push more in a Disney direction overall.
Oh yeah,
sure.
Well,
yeah.
I mean,
they already are.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's due to all the money that Disney's pulling in these days, you can understand why they'd be looking at that, and just the fact that there's always been there's some parallels drawn between the two, down the years.
And I think the advantage is the more you sign these license deals where, you can make toys for us, you can make a movie for us, the other partner now has the onus to invest some of their money in any kind of pop-up operation to sell merch because they get a cut and they're promoting your brand on your behalf and you're not having to pay for it. And in fact, you're getting paid for their promoting your brand on your behalf. Merchandising is a weird business. that's just the end. Merchandising is a fucking strange business.
Mm-hmm.
Last email?
We're ready? Well, Michael writes, how do you feel about the recent bigger is better trend when it comes to a game's world map? More than ever, I feel like publishers and media are using a game's map size as a selling point. Skyrim, Fallout 4, and Witcher 3 are well known for their enormous world maps. Xenoblade Chronicles X was advertised as being bigger than all three of them combined. The only thing we know about the new Zelda game is that it will feature a huge open world. These are all highly respected games, but they highlight both an industry-wide trend and a potential pitfall. My concern is with games trying to be large for the sake of being large. It's very easy for these massive games to feel empty. Too many games could take filler content that ends up being skipped over with fast travel systems. A good counterexample to this is The Witness, a lengthy game that takes place on a small island jam-packed with puzzles. By the end of the game, the player will learn every inch of the island. My question is, how big is too big? When do we begin to see diminishing returns? Do you think Nintendo and others will continue to adopt this trend as hardware and player tastes evolve?
This trend has been going on for a long time. I remember like Burnout Paradise, I think, like already they were like jamming the map of another EA game into the map of Burnout Paradise. They were like, look, it's so much bigger. And
I mean, you could roll that back all the way to like 360 near launch window with like Elder Scroll. With like, look how big these Elder Scrolls... John, which Elder Scroll was that?
Oblivion.
Oblivion, yeah. Like, look how big this game is.
Like, you have to ask. It's like, of course it was fucking Oblivion.
Yeah. I mean, it's in the name, really.
It's apparently too big for me to ever beat.
You played that to exhaustion, haven't you, John?
Well, I've played, like, the opening about 5 times over to exhaustion.
Hmm. Nice.
But yeah, like, we talked about this a few times kind of a different way. Like, when we're talking about Twilight Princess, I was trying to make the point that in the PlayStation 1 era... playtime was the metric that had to be like you had to pad your game. Like, as a developer, the publisher wanted you to pad your game because Final Fantasy VII sold millions and Final Fantasy VII was, you know, like 40, 50, 60 hours. And so you had that. That's what marketers thought that players valued. And
But I mean, the Order 1886, people killed that game because it takes you like 7 or 8 hours to play through.
Right. Yeah,
I
so
mean,
that mindset is still around.
I agree I agree that marketing, you know, has something to do with it, but also, you know, there's a reason for that, which is that I think there are quite a few players that, you know, have this kind of, well, how many hours it, well, it's not worth, if it's this many hours, it's worth $40. If it's this many hours, it might be worth 60. You know, there is that kind of thinking that goes on.
Yep.
I mean,
but designing missions, designing unique encounters is tough. And also, it's not really repeatable, right?
Well, like,
it's
earning $60 is tough too, though. So, I mean, keep that in mind.
Right. No, I know. But I'm just saying, like, the working on a game, trying to make it as long as possible, what are the easiest ways to do that? When you're an indie developer, you're going to try to make it procedurally generated, perhaps. Mm-hmm. If you're a big AAA studio, you're going to have 600 Ubisoft employees all working on something and creating this huge map that you're going to get the players to go from point A to point B to point C and always like on the other side of the city or whatever you're exploring. And that's the way that you pad your game. That's,
get,
you know,
get
quote
Ubisoft
unquote,
Shanghai on the phone.
Right. Oh. Anyway, like it's just, I don't know, like it seems to be like the design trend these days.
Yeah, I think it's
so
the latest,
far it works.
I think it's the latest manifestation of something, you know, that you have seen before. Yeah, like you said, it maybe in previous incarnations, it's been more focused on playtime rather than, you know, the actual sort of expanse of the physical sort of game world, so to speak. But, you know, I don't think Nintendo are really that bad about caving into this sort of thing. You know, I mean, I think, you know, if you look at the way the Mario games have changed over the years, 3D Mario in particular.
Yeah.
You know, I think you start with Super Mario 64, and a big selling point of that, it's revolutionary, it's this great step forward in game design, and also like, oh, there's this big, you know, these big worlds that you could just go anywhere in because it's 3D and all this kind of stuff. And then Sunshine kind of indulged that to some extent, you know, in the areas that weren't in the, like, the void levels or stuff like that, you know, where it was like, okay, now they're even bigger. You know, and there's these big places to go and explore. But then they've been reining it in. You know, the Galaxy 2, 3D Land, 3D World. They've been saying, yeah, no, actually, that's not really what we think Mario's about. You know, we are going to, like, focus it down to challenges and stuff, and we might make it sort of more densely packed with, like, tricky collectibles or stuff, but it's not going to be about just, oh, look, this is enormous, go out there and do it. You know, I think it's, you know, look, in terms of the general question about, you know, when is it too much, I mean, that's going to be different for different people to a large extent. You know, how much you enjoy just going out into a world and exploring it, and therefore, you know, how much you're going to get out of how vast it is, you know, partly just a function of your personal preference.
Well, it's also game worlds are like sex. It's not the size, it's what you do with it.
Well, you know, I had hope, John.
Favorite part about that joke is that the only person laughing is John, who can't even keep it together.
I was impressed.
I've been thinking about it and trying not to laugh for like 5 minutes.
I was really impressed that I managed to get past
that. Which is twice as long as it normally takes you, right, John? There, boom!
I'm back, I'm telling you, man.
I was impressed that I managed to get past the how big is too big without a giggle from you, John. Unless you were mute in the moment. I gave you too much credit after that, evidently. No, you know, the point is that, like I said, you've got different tastes. So some people, you know, I think some people can have a way higher tolerance for just like, oh, it's really huge. Like, but then there is what you do with it. There is actually how is this world designed? You know, there are such a thing as like good vast game worlds and not so good ones, you know, in terms of how well designed they are and how it ties into the gameplay. I mean, the one thing I'd say about Xenoblade, both of the games, you know, have pretty sizable worlds. Obviously, the Xenoblade X has a much more open one and much bigger as well. But, the first one was pretty big too. And I would just say, you know, for me, what I loved about exploring those worlds was in part the scale, but it was really what the scale delivered in terms of the feeling of being in another place and seeing things, you know, that you hadn't seen in other games.
Yeah, I mean,
I think
the scale seemed meaningful to me.
You know, just that, you know, like I said, that you're in a kind of sci-fi fantasy place, you know, like that they actually gave it that sense of being in that place. And I just think, you know, the one thing I'd say about Zelda is that, you know, unless they're going to really do some things which, you know, off the reservation compared to previous Zelda games, I'm not sure that you could achieve that same sort of effect with something that's just that kind of standard fantasy landscape, you know, the Hyrule that, you know, we kind of generate, whether it's literally called Hyrule or not, you know, there's a volcano, there's grasslands, there's a desert, there's a lake, there's a waterfall, there's a river, you know.
people got that feeling from Skyrim. I haven't played it, but like people, like that was a pretty game, right? And people enjoyed exploring that world. But it is the standard kind of Norse mythology fantasy, thing.
I think the one thing that Xenoblade does differently, though, is the scale. It's not just the world is scaled; it's that everything in it is scaled. So do you spend a lot of the game running between the legs of giant dinosaurs?
Like, yep.
There's a certain sense that the world is big, and
yeah, it's too big for you, especially in Exia, because you are, you know, alien, you know, on this planet. So
right.
it kind of just gives sort of intuitive life to the actual scenario that the game's putting forth. You know, I think that's really important. Mm-hmm. With Zelda, I just, you know, like I said, unless it's going to be really different from the aesthetically and everything from other Zeldas, I don't really see them sort of achieving that. So then if it's not going to be kind of being evocative of scale and grandeur and just the weirdness of Xenoblade's worlds, you know, is what I always liked. And just these sites that, you know, how much they must have had to work on this in concept art and all this stuff to get to this point, you know, and all. Whereas, again, I go, with Zelda, if you're having a big world, I think it is going to have to work more from a nuts and bolts design perspective. And that is a lot harder to do well just with you're making it big. You know, you've really got to justify it at that point. And that's
you can't just throw a bunch of huge monsters in there and say, and have that make it interesting, because that doesn't even fit the series.
Well, I guess that's why you make it so that every two steps your controller vibrates and you have to bum the floor to find a secret.
That's just life. That's just what life
the
is.
The Stone of Agony would be aptly named if that were the case.
I do think, when I think about the Zelda games, I think about, you know, the one I played most recently, Twilight Princess. A lot of times, it's like, okay, I need to go back and get the horse because I have to run across this big empty space to get to back to town. Whereas in Xenoblade, I never felt like I had to have the scale. Like, I was like, okay, I'll hoof it for a little while, then I'll warp somewhere to get the scale back.
Yeah.
So I think it's more of a, well, and I the one thing I say as a positive, though, is this is the first, Skyward Sword aside, which tried to do something very different. Skyward Sword actually tried to be very constricted. I mean, it was very
much... I mean, look, Skyward Sword tried to say, okay, these areas are going to be very kind of heavily designed, you know, we're almost getting a bit more Metroid-y, you know, where it's like, okay, there's elements of, you know, kind of environmental puzzle solving and retraversal, you know, will be a bit faster because now you've got an item that lets you skip out steps A, B, and C or something, you know, like that was a lot more designed than just what James was talking about, where it's like, hey, here's an expanse to give things a feeling of scale and
that they're big,
to put some distance in a very real sense between, you know, Gerudo Valley and wherever else.
Right.
You know, so, you know, I think that's the thing. One of the things I really liked about Skyward Sword in some ways was the fact that, you know, the places outside the dungeons felt quite meticulously designed. I think the problem was ultimately that, as Guillaume said, it's hard to do that.
Then, it didn't feel like a world. It felt like levels that had levels inside them.
Well, sure. I think that's a fair point. You know, and the sort of segmentation and stuff that happened as a result. But as Guillaume said, it is difficult to do that. And so what they found was they did it to the extent they could do it and then said, oh, this game isn't long enough. And that's when they started putting in the junk to just kind of use it again, you know. And that's some of the most disagreeable stuff in the game. Now, I believe that the better thing to do would just simply let the game be shorter. You know, I think at some point that is something that should be embraced, because ultimately, you know, I suppose it's a kind of a natural thing, I guess, for, you know, when you're an adult, you've got less free time, you know, you're quite happy for it to be short and sweet, or at least shorter and sweeter, you know, but my advice at that point would be, just like, hey, make it leaner, and I'm happy with a more condensed experience. But clearly, that's not how Nintendo thinks about Zelda. I mean, how many times do they have to demonstrate it to us? The Triforce hunt in Wind Waker, some of the stuff in Twilight Princess. I mean, they've been doing virtually, it seems like every time they make a new big 3D Zelda game, they get there and say, it's not long enough.
Well, and I would say,
how can we make it longer? You know,
I would say that the dump, Well, John, you go first.
Well, I was just going to say, in Chronicles X, it's very obvious that from the ground up, they said, we're going to make this map, and we're going to have every single segment on this map have some kind of activity.
Right.
Like, so in other words, the size of the map is meaningful because of the way they designed it to have meaning.
Everything has a thing, essentially.
Yep.
And
yeah, but at the same time, it's kind of arbitrary, though. It's just like, okay, here it's a monster, here it's a chest that you open.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, but it's not just open space. Like, even like in Skyrim, for the size of that world, there's a lot of it where you're just on your horse traversing just an empty field.
No, like I said, I think the Xenoblade Chronicles X is interesting because it's not heavily designed like a Skyward. So, you know, it's fairly, you know, I mean, you could just swim around, play, you could go anywhere, you know, that's part of his appeal is that, you know, you don't have to wait until you've got X, Y, and Z in your inventory to navigate these places necessarily.
Yeah, the map opens up in only like 2 moments when you get your scale and you can jump.
Yep.
And with the scale, and then when you can fly.
You don't gain that much real estate in either case. The fly one, you gain quite a bit.
And there's some stuff that's way up in the air, you know, that obviously is just for those.
But you may not even been able to see that stuff
before. Yeah, you would not necessarily even known it was there. So it's not, but the point is, it's not that heavily designed, but at the same time, I feel like, you know, it generally avoids being just an expanse. In terms of just, if nothing else, it's more visually interesting than that. You know, it's certainly more visually interesting. Again, this kind of goes back to just the overall theme and aesthetic that I've kind of talked about before. But, you know, just that, you know, you will see great sunken saucers in the distance, you know, and you think, well, I can see it, so I'm going to be able to go there, you know, and stuff like that, even if it is a bloody big expanse between you and it, you know, whereas I'm struggling to imagine, you know, what you could have in a Zelda game that you're going to see off in the distance and be that excited about. It's just not that weird and wonderful. It's just, you know, that's not what generally has brought people into the Zelda franchise over the years. I think exploration has been, but it's generally been more of a kind of mechanical kind of exploration in terms of finding secrets and, you know, using like new items to expose new parts of the map or to do new things in it, rather than just, I want to see all this stuff. All these places.
I would point you to, well, two things, I guess. First, I'll, just to finish the conversation on Skyward Sword real quick, so we can never talk about that game again.
goodness.
I would say that in that case, Xenoblade and Xenoblade Chronicles X work better because in Skyward Sword, the overworld was literally nothing. It was air, and there was nothing in it.
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing that, you know, I think...
It was brutal.
It maybe could have alleviated some of the issues in the game, you know, if they found a way to kind of make that a more meaningful component of the world.
Because you were literally moving through a void between spaces. And the game I would compare that to is one of these progenitors of a specific type of open-world gameplay, the open-world climb towers stuff. The first Assassin's Creed game, which took place in the Middle East... The cities were all quite well designed, although the AI seemed to have no idea how to traverse them. but when you went between like Acre and Jerusalem, you were literally riding a horse through a narrow canyon like 30 feet wide that zigzagged back and forth until you reached Acre, let's say 2 miles down the road, which isn't geographically accurate. But also, it just feels really pointless. You're like, well, why not just let me hot swap to what city I'm in? This is... Like there was this concept of they have to show you moving through space, and I think some of the open world games get stuck in that, where we have to show you're going to a different place, but we can't really afford to make everything between here and there, because at some point there has to be a wall, be it visible or invisible.
Yep.
And in Xenoblade there is actually invisible walls. I found them, like, but you have to go pretty far. But what I think, actually, to your question of how do you make things in the distance seem enticing, I think you go back to Xenoblade Chronicles, which is a significantly less fantasy-driven world. I mean, it is and it isn't.
Well, it's very fantastical in one sense, in that you know, you've got the fact that you're like on a bipedal giant, but
it's much more Earth-like.
I don't think it's as kind of crazy. It's the alienness of the world in is much more pronounced in Mira in X.
And how that game does it is it does things to sort of draw your eyes to a spot. So there's, and I talked about the Machna waterfall, which you have to swim for forever to get to it because it's so far. Like, it doesn't look far away because it's gigantic.
Because it's basically featureless, isn't it? That's because it is so just a massive expanse of water.
Right. It's so
big.
That
was kind of curiosity, you know, with that one, wasn't it? Well, it's like, just like, are they really going to let me go all the way over there?
Well, so you don't realize how far all the way over is. It's like a 4 or 5 minute swim to the middle island and then another 4 or 5 minutes to the rest of the way. And you're just thinking, holy crap, is it still, it doesn't seem like I'm getting any closer. And I'm starting to wonder, like, is it really getting, and then no, it's slowly getting there. And then you get there and there's almost nothing, but you do it. There's like there's an item back there. And maybe there's one of that games, like, here's a level 147 enemy. Have fun. But the one that I think of is, the finger that you had to climb all the way up on the arm.
And oh yeah, that's so memorable.
It's not even necessarily immediately apparent it's a finger, but it's a space, and there's just this spire, and your eyes are immediately drawn to it, and you just keep panning up and saying, "Oh my god, how big is that thing? I need to get up there." And I think you could do that in a Zelda game. I think you could have a cliff way over on the horizon, or you could have maybe a fortress perched up on something, or a cave that you could see, but you're not entirely sure how to get there. Anything that is immediately grabs your eyes when you sort of scan the environment and stands out to the point where you know it was designed. Like somebody said, this needs to be here so you come look at it. And I think one advantage that they have when they're making this game versus perhaps Skyward Sword, although Monolith was in-house at that point.
Yeah,
is that
and he's
Monolith,
on the credits for that game.
Monolith is much more deeply ingrained in the Nintendo culture now than they were in 2009, 2010? Like they are very deep into what Nintendo is doing. They're working on pretty much every Nintendo game. They are, you know, they've got support teams. They've made 2 Xenoblade games at this point. They're definitely around to talk. And I think maybe that's when Nintendo's teams are willing to share experience and kind of lean on each other and not pull like old school Rare where this team's in this barn and this team's in this barn and never talk to each other ever. Like the idea that sharing experience and sharing design ideas. I really hope if they're making an open Zelda game, they go talk to, they're talking to people who have made these open games and aren't just, as the letter, to get back to the letter's idea, saying, well, we have to do this because we think this is going to get people excited about Zelda when they haven't necessarily been recently.
Yeah.
Tying it back to topic.
It's a weird one. Like I said, I mean, for me, with the new Zelda, I think we still don't, you know, to almost have this as the sort of recurring disclaimer. We still know remarkably little about it and how, you know, yes, the implication is that it's going to be more open than previous Zeldas in terms of, you know, what order you can do dungeons in and stuff. But in terms of the world design, you know, there's a hell of a lot of unanswered questions. How open it's going to be, we shall see. You know, they've kind of said, well, you know, our idea of a kind of open game might be quite different from other people's. And to a large extent, I hope that's the case because, you know, just think I'd like to see, you know, what sort of spin Nintendo could do on it. But back to the sort of core question about just, you know, when is it disproportionate, when are you getting too large to kind of make an effective game? I think, you know, it's always got to come back to the kind of fundamental game design that you're looking to achieve. I mean, and also just the kind of fundamental experience that you're trying to achieve. I mean, in something like Xenoblade, you know, in both cases, but certainly with the second one, you know, as much as anything, what they're trying to do is put you in that place, put you in a place that feels fantastic, feels, you know, alien, something completely different. And I think it's kind of, you know, it's essential really in Xenoblade X to give you that feeling of being on an alien world, that it is that vast, that it feels too vast for you, you know? You know, so I think there's downsides to it in terms of the sort of moment to moment gameplay that I can understand, but probably overall, you know, maybe it's worth the trade-offs to make. Where, yeah, but say for instance, if you're making quite a different kind of game, you know, which isn't about, you know, something where you've created all this crazy kind of alien stuff, that, you know, you have, people haven't seen before, and again,
I just, you know, I think then it's a lot harder to justify having it be huge unless you really have like all this stuff to do in it. But I mean, has anybody managed that yet? Has anybody spent long enough on a game yet that they have this vast open world and it feels like they weren't just kind of smattering busy work all over it to give right. something to do? No, I mean, we have a problem with game budgets and scope as it is, you know, the yep. idea that anyone would spend the time and money required to make something that, you know, held up to the visual standards and all that kind of the production values that we expect from sort of the top level games these days and have that level of sort of thought out content. It's just, I just don't think it's economic right now. So, mm-hmm. you know, that to me is, I think it certainly should be adjusted to the scope of the project in most cases, you know, unless it's sort of essential to the quality, you know, the whole nature of the experience, like it is in something like Xenoblade. I think it's much healthier to rein that in to a place that's proportionate with the kind of game design that you know how to do, that you want to do.
I mean, you see it even in shooters, where shooters have like empty blind alleys, and you're like, why is this even here? You know?
I just hope that Nintendo hasn't like gotten a cheap intern to put silver rupees to on every peak that James is dreaming about.
Yes.
This is it. You know,
can't fit this in my wallet.
It's a chest, and every time you have to watch him pick it up over his head and then put it back in the chest. Yeah. It's open world in a new way. You yep. have to actually watch the animation of it going back in, and then him, instead of looking happy, just looking sullen.
Welcome.
And just plays a song. Just plays it backwards, and Link just looks depressed.
No, I think it, you know, like I said, all this stuff is about proportions to me. As we said, you know, there's a proportion that's right for Twilight Princess, and they overran it. You know, and there was putting the pad in. There was probably a proportion that would be right for Skyward Sword, and they overran that. And that's the thing. I mean, in that sense, I'm not terribly optimistic that this won't be a bit out of whack, because that tends to be the track record. But it's not like it kills those games, you know. I mean, Wind Waker and Twilight Princess and Skyward Sword, you know, I still enjoyed all of them. But you know, I guess the question is whether in this case the sheer size of the world is kind of going to be the padding, essentially. Like, I mean, I don't think that's necessarily altogether like worse than the padding we've had before, but it is just that in a different form. So I don't welcome it anymore.
This has been an interesting discussion on why 2D Zelda will always be superior to 3D Zelda.
All right. You know what? DS 2D Zelda will always be superior to 3D Zelda. Good. Yes. I'm glad we settled that.
A Link Between Worlds will always be superior to every other Zelda.
Yep.
And on that, that was the end of our email for the week. You can send us your email to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. As a reminder, it is time for our next retroactive, which is Beautiful Joe on the GameCube/PS2, if you can get it that way, because it is cheaper. We got a couple questions about how to play this game. No, it is not currently available in any form on Wii U unless you are willing to hack the Wiimote of your Wii U to play this thing, which you can do, but I'm not encouraging that. Hopefully you still have a Wii or a GameCube you can play this game on, or something that can play the PS2 version.
I'll let everybody know that I have combed the GameStops in my area for cheap copies of this game, and I have jacked them up in price on eBay. So you're
welcome.
Good job, John. You're welcome to bid.
John
just,
is
just making some money off of this, off
John
this enterprise.
John is the hero we all deserve.
Martin Shkreli is shit.
Thank you, John. Thank you. So we will be doing that. I think I said it'll be the third week of February. I'm gonna hold to that for right now.
Sure.
I'll have a definitive date hopefully in the article, but of course we may move it depending on what we've been able to accomplish with the game, because we obviously have to play the game to get it. But
I would recommend people start playing it soon, because level 4 just never fucking ends.
It's true, actually. It never ends, ever.
Never.
The original reviewers of this game are still going. So, the Nintendo Report will have a review for this game someday, but we don't yet. So, there's a talkback thread right now where you can post your comments about the game, questions, you know, get help. I suppose as much as help can be delivered textually in this game. Or just post your thoughts about the game, and they may end up in the episode when we have it. or questions for us or whatever, or you can send them to the email address. Again, it's rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. So that will do it for this week. John, I would say it was a pleasure to have you back, but you ruined it with that one joke.
Hey, if I can just ruin one show, then my job is done.
Well, congratulations.
Let's just get out of the way.
Mission accomplished. So it's time to announce the ending music for this week. And just as a reminder, you can send us the music you want to hear either in the threads for the episode, or you can send us an email. I'm not going to say the email address again. I said it three times already. But it's rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. So this week's was submitted to us in the forums, again, from Mr. Top Hat Ant, and it is the Mysterious Muramasa Castle Medley from Smash for 3DS and Wii U. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Later. Yeah, like, please contact me on Twitter or whatever, GuillaumeNWR, and look for the spelling for my name on the website. Don't write any letter. Yeah, don't write any letter willy nilly and send a letter. That doesn't.
Guillaume. Yeah. That's the pronunciation for you Anglophones out there.
Oh my God.
Wait, I've been saying it wrong this whole time?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, Guillaume.
News flash.
I am the worst host.
Guillaume.
So
it's like Fruit of the Loom. So.
What a train wreck this is.
Please
John's been back. John's been back on the show for 20 minutes and 43 seconds, and he has already completely...
I've got my part of responsibility here, but anyway.
You didn't do this. You didn't... Not like this, John.
Fruit of the Loom.
All right, well, speaking of driving the show into a place it doesn't belong,